Welcome to the podcast for creating true wealth and a lasting legacy as a result of effectively managing financial wealth, creating purposeful impact, and ensuring succession and continuation. Everyone wants to live a life full of purpose and meaning and leave a positive legacy. Yet, so many people just drift along and never really ask the underlying questions. The purpose of this podcast is to share insights and strategies that allow you to find and define your purpose to create the lasting legacy you want for yourself and for generations to come. We get one life and opportunity to make a real and meaningful impact and find true wealth. This is the True Wealth Project podcast with your host, Sasha Janssen. Subscribe to this podcast to never miss an episode, and don't forget to also subscribe to the True Wealth newsletter to receive educational content and action steps to help you find your purpose and create the legacy you want to leave. Today, I want to welcome Dr. Richard Orlando. Richard was born and raised in New York City and resides in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, with his wife and children. For the past 25 years, Richard has sat at boardroom and kitchen tables alike, advising high and ultra high net worth families, many at the helm of family enterprises. He has also trained thousands of advisors to build upon financial advising to include the qualitative multi-generational planning needs of their client families. Prior to founding Legacy Capitals, he led Merrill Lynch's Global Practice Management Consulting Group and served in Merrill's family office. He has been referenced in numerous publications, including The New York Times, Bloomberg Business, and The Wall Street Journal Online. Richard holds a degree in computer science and business and a master's degree in counseling and theology. He also earned a doctorate in family systems. He's an approved instructor for the Investment Wealth and Wealth Institute, a faculty member of the Ultra High Net Worth Institute, holds a certificate in family wealth advising from the Family Firm Institute, and is certified as a professional coach from the International Coach Federation's accredited program. Additionally, he's also the author of Legacy, The Hidden Keys to Optimizing Your Family Wealth Decisions, and Love Your Clients, The Tale of the Whole Family Advisor. Richard sits on the board of directors for Urban Hope in Staten Island. Hello, Richard. Welcome to the True Wealth Project podcast.
Sasha, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You're very welcome. And I'm deeply impressed by your bio. That's actually the reason why I read it out aloud. And I tried to shorten it, but I just couldn't, because you have an impressive array of qualifications, experience, and credentials. And I'm really always quite curious, you know, what my guests, what has been their journey and why they've taken the different steps to get there. So maybe as an introduction, you can just briefly take us through, well, how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Thank you. And I think a part of the build of the bio is, if you live long enough, you get to do enough things and it looks more impressive. But yes. I think most relevant to your listeners and this larger topic of the True Wealth Project, I would boil it down to that I always had a interest, a passion, and even a natural wiring to understand and to see if I can help move people along in their journey. Mm-hmm. When I look back, that's how one of the ways I interpret it. But I didn't really know I was going to end up where I am today, or where my team is today in terms of Legacy Capitals. But through college, I went right to Wall Street, worked in a big investment banking firm, then went on for my master's after that in counseling and theology to kind of study more the legacy, bigger meaning topics in life. And then once I got that motor running for the master's program, I knew I was going to go right on for the doctoral level studies mm-hmm. in family psychology, family systems. I then went back to Wall Street, Merrill Lynch Private Bank, and had an amazing opportunity for 15 years to, first, my primary role was, as you read off there, is to run, Merrill has had and has an internal consulting group that does training and coaching to their advisors all over the country. Mm-hmm. And when I was running it, all over the world. So I was fortunate to be able to work alongside and advisors in throughout Europe, a little bit in the Middle East and Asia. But because I also had a PhD in family psychology and my dissertation was on basically family businesses in wealth management, the firm, the head of the private bank said, why aren't you serving our clients directly? The clients meaning those that the advisors had responsibilities and stewardship over. And so that was now almost two decades ago where I was really fortunate to start serving the ultra high net worth family wherever they were in partnership with the advisors. So that all came together, but I can't say I had mapped that out. I was just fortunate that it all weaved together with my desire to just keep moving forward and figuring out how I can help mostly on the qualitative side of people's journeys. I'm quite familiar with the financial side, but I was never an investment person or anything like that. So that's – go ahead.
Yeah, please. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's a short version of – I feel very fortunate that it weaved together, but I wasn't smart enough to map that out.
Okay, but I mean your topics, and we'll discuss that in a bit more detail. But you know your topics about family wealth and sort of intergenerational wealth and the topic of legacy, that is like a thread throughout your career. So what was so appealing about that topic, or was it just a coincidence that one step led to another?
Yeah, great observation. I would say again a little bit more that I'm learning as I look back, but I would say the thread that probably was there started with all my grandparents came over from Italy. And I remember specifically one set of my grandparents always highlighting to the family at large, which there was six children on one side, nine children on the other side, this idea of staying together as family, always moving together as family.
Yeah.
Or even the topic I remember we have on video, my one set of grandparents saying, we're not going to always be here, so make sure you all stay together, talking to their children and then their children being our parents and aunts and uncles.
Yeah.
So I think it was somewhat embedded in the culture I was part of, that there's this family thing that's to go on.
Wow,
now, I wasn't conscious of that.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that drove a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I mean, I have five kids now, and mm-hmm. certainly a topic that, you know, is more on the front of our minds, to think about, you know, how can we create that family unity for the longer term? Because
right.
I think it's not something that Western society generally mm-hmm. encourages these days. So, I mean, you know, everybody's supposed to be individualistic and independent and have free choices, etc. And sort of, you know, family is a little bit of the opposite of that. Although, well, we'll talk about that later, I think.
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, your topics of family wealth, intergenerational wealth and legacy, and your extensive experience in that sector, that they make me really eager to extract some of the key concepts that you have come up with for the benefit of our audience. And maybe a good starting point for that is your book, Legacy, because that basically seems to sum up the subject more or less perfectly. Now, I have to admit that I haven't read the entire book, but I've had a glimpse across it, and I read the introduction. But maybe you can give us a high-level summary of what the book is about. And, I mean, obviously it's about legacy, but, about, you know, mm-hmm. maybe a sentence more on that. And what motivated you to write it in this particular way?
Yeah. So when I began the work inside of corporate America, meaning Merrill Lynch's private bank, and then doing that work, fortunately, globally, it was the first time I got to serve families in the way I was serving them. Just real quick, when I go back, when I was doing my PhD and my master's, part of that training was I had to do internships. I was a therapist. I was a counselor. So it wasn't new for me to be alongside individuals, couples, and families on their journeys. But this was different. This was different in the sense that it was in the context of families who were leading big businesses or enterprises and had significant resources. So in that work, to your question, as I was doing it a number of years now, I was starting to kind of had this intuitive feeling that there was too many conventional answers that I saw our industry offering our clients.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they were conventional or too limited in scope, what I was seeing from my lens and my experience is families, yes, of course, they need good governance, especially for their assets and enterprises to flourish across the generations. But that's not all they need. And as a matter of fact, it may be important to have, but some of the other less black and white topics of legacy and purpose and values and human dynamics and the journey of life, I found was not really being part of what professionals were doing in serving clients. So I just started to wonder that there must be something more. And maybe that's obvious because of my background and some of my training in philosophy and theology and maybe just psychology as well, obviously. So some of the motivation was this feels important. What I was like learning from peers and professional organizations, it was definitely important and still is important, but it was limiting. And I thought, okay, what small part could I play in advancing the industry my peers or those who are my mentors, those who are ahead of me, to kind of build out how we think about who families are and their purpose of their wealth, in addition to their governance, their tax planning, their estate planning, and all of that. That was a big motivation.
Yeah, I agree from my own observation that a lot of the solutions that are on offer are sort of very narrow in focus. I mean, they tend to focus on the investment management aspect or the tax aspect or the legal aspect, and it's a lot more than that if you try to set something up for the real long term. And I mean, I'm not by any means ultra high net worth, but I am thinking about the longer term future, and I want to build something that outlasts my personal life. And I do find it challenging, and maybe my sort of size bracket is even more underserved because I think there are a lot of people catering for the 100 million plus community, but sort of if you are a just regular, normal, high net worth individual or something in that sphere, I haven't really found any solutions that really cater for a holistic type of planning. So that's my observation anyway, so I can confirm what you're saying. And I'm sure that even for high, very high net worth individuals, it's not much different, even though there's a lot more on offer, but it tends to be quite limited in scope.
And if I may, Sasha, going back to the purpose of, or the maybe the motivations behind why the legacy book, that was one. That was a big one. That was the overarching one. Was let me see if I can't throw my perspective into the mix, and therefore ultimately benefit the families we serve. But there was a specific moment I remember is Jay Hughes, who's one of my mentors, and a pioneer in this work. In one of his books that really have been a foundation to this kind of work. He, I think it's in the introduction. Don't quote me on that. But he says something along the lines of that if families don't have love or their spiritual capital in place, it's going to be hard for them to flourish. Yeah. And he beautifully leaves it there, but he doesn't, at least not in that book. and this is not a critique because he's my mentor, but it was such a powerful statement, but it wasn't operationalized. I thought it was an opportunity to take that idea and develop it so that we could do something about this intangible topic of love and spiritual capital.
Yeah.
And that was the other thread that was behind, and the other important motivation behind the book Legacy that I wrote.
Yeah, love it, love it. So I mean, maybe, you know, to start with the sort of very basics, what even is a legacy in your definition?
Yeah. I think it's a few things. I think it's the impressions, the memories, the experiences, the manifestation in the material world as well. For example, it could be an orphanage that was and is supported by a family. It could be a wing of a hospital. It could be a name on a stadium. But I think it's probably what's lasting is that internal experience and memory of the people before us. It's their reputation. It's the overall experience one had with them. And when I do some trainings or speaking on the topic of legacy, one of the things I'll do is I'll put up a picture or pictures of people, celebrities or public figures, and I'll say, what do you think while they're alive, what do you think their legacy stands for? And it's not that hard to go, well, they're known to be really smart and impactful or generous or greedy or right. And I think it's things like that probably ultimately that's the part that we remember internally. Externally, which is relevant, is how might their wealth have been manifested, like the Rockefellers Foundation. They're impacting people all over the world with what they're doing. So I think it has an internal and external quality.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So why should an entrepreneurial parent or family even think about the concept of a legacy? I mean, why does it matter, in other words?
I think it's easier to answer that is that they usually very much care about that topic, whether they're conscious of saying it or not, on their loved ones and maybe also their charitable targets. I think they want to know that what they're doing is serving some purpose.
Mm-hmm.
The broader question is, what does it all mean at the end if I'm no longer here? I think there are some people that'll take that view, but I think most are living consciously or unconsciously in a way that they want to make a mark. They don't want to feel like, and this is one of those existential kind of perspectives, but they don't want to feel like their life was didn't have any meaning, didn't have any impact. That's how I think about it.
Yeah. Well, I would tend to agree. I mean, and I think that's, you know, legacy is not something that is limited to people with lots of money. But on the other hand, if you spent your life making a lot of money and building wealth, you know, what's the point if you don't make it count somehow? So, you know, I think it's just basically a waste if you let it go to pieces. But that's just my personal take. But I think that's pretty much along lines.
I want to echo something you just said. You're absolutely right. Like, even though our work is working mostly with those who have significant financial resources, the topic of legacy, and for that matter, philanthropy, is not just for those who have financial resources. There's no doubt. This is everyone, every day is in some way shaping a legacy, whether they're trying to do it or not. If you also have financial resources, you could do it in other ways too. That's an important point you just raised for sure.
Yeah, and it's also an important point that you raised because you talked about, you know, that we're creating a legacy whether we are conscious of it or not. So it's you know, you have a choice to make it intentional, but you will leave some form of legacy regardless.
Correct. And we actually emphasize in our work, and as I do in the book, that we focus a lot more, if I could be practical for a moment, when advisors are serving families of significant means, by definition, part of their planning should involve, we'll call it end of life planning. Some people will refer to that as legacy planning. Mm-hmm. And I've done it now twice for my family, where I've did it the first time and then had to update it because my children are older. But that's important. But usually families don't like to do that planning because that makes them think of death and when they're not here. So we really focus more on how do we help those we serve live their legacy.
Mm. Yeah.
So you hit on the word intended. So part of the work we do, and we have some tools to help families do it, and we have some training to help advisors have these conversations with their clients, is what is their intended legacy? And now the work is how do we help them live that intention?
Yeah.
And that's much more energizing. That brings life back to the death conversation.
Yes.
That's really what we think it's. That's an example of when I said earlier that I felt some of the too many of the responses and best practices, quote unquote, of serving families was too one-dimensional, like legacy planning. Okay, let's make sure my homes and my business and my foundation are all properly packaged. And that's very, very, you have to do that. But if you stop there, you've missed so much of the value and the life that people have.
Yeah. Well, I really like that framing because, as you say, you know, it sort of it shifts the energy completely away from planning for your death to, you know, how do I live my life, or how do I want to live it, and focus on that part rather than the end game.
You got it.
Yeah. Okay, so when I had a glimpse through the book, the first thing that really spoke to me was the concept of the five types of capital that you mentioned, and the concept of spiritual capital in particular. And if you've just mentioned it earlier briefly, but what are the five types of capital, and what do they mean?
Sure. Well, I have to acknowledge that I wasn't the one at all that came up with the concepts of different capitals. I learned recently that the Glenn Lowry, who's a tenured professor at, I believe, Brown, originally came up with social capital. He's an economics professor. Mm-hmm. I know that I mentioned earlier Jay Hughes was using the term spiritual capital and others. Mm-hmm. So there was these capitals that were being used in different professional areas. And this is another example of where I felt like, okay, I'm glad that they're using them, but I thought they were missing something, in the sense that what I did with, so the five capitals that we, again, kind of borrowed but framed differently, mm-hmm. Is based on is the acronym FISHES. FISHS. So F is the financial capital. Everyone knows that. I is the intellectual capital.
Yeah.
First S is social capital. Then H is human capital. And then S is spiritual capital. Mm-hmm. What I was finding, so that framing, in the way we framed it, that would be the unique part. And the second part, that what I did differently, was most people might not even use the term spiritual, because that has hair on it for people. That makes some people say, well, I'm not spiritual, I'm not religious, so therefore people tend to avoid that language. And or they bury it inside the human capital category.
Yeah.
Or maybe another social. And I thought it has so much uniqueness and influence on what we do, that I pulled it out and I made it its own capital, if I could put it that way. And so really, it was funny. I remember driving with my wife when I was writing the book and working on that chapter. I was like, how do I take this very intangible topic of spiritual capital and try to operationalize it, which was one of my goals.
Yeah.
And so the other capitals are somewhat self-evident: financial, intellectual, and that would be, before I get back to spiritual capital, intellectual would be more like the formal and life experiences of learning, right? Whether you go to get your doctorate or you're just learning a lot in life because you started a business
yeah.
and you learn building a business, as an
yeah.
example.
Yeah.
Social, we define it as the network of relationships that you're part of, whether they're your family, whether they're your colleagues, whether they're the community, whether they're the world.
Yeah.
And in those networks are resources, whether that's love to money or access. And then the human is really your natural wiring, your attributes, who you are, your physical well-being, your value. Well, not the values. We move that to spiritual capital. So there's an element of, okay, let's understand you as the individual family member. Then the spiritual capital, what I ultimately landed on was this formula, which says that your purpose plus your values times your faith with a lowercase f, not faith as in any particular religion at all.
Yeah.
And what I try to argue or make the case for in the book is that that is our personal GPS, our life's purpose, our values, and whatever we believe is to be the higher reason for our existence. Some people will put a literal meaning to that, like they're Christians and they anchor themselves, like I do, on the Christian faith. But whether you do that or not, there's still something about people anchoring themselves or finding themselves tied to a larger philosophy or ideology of why things are the way they are.
Yeah.
And when you put that formula together, which I know is a crazy idea, it really will help someone identify what I call their personal GPS, which is really what's navigating our decisions.
Yeah.
And so that's where the S comes in, is the spiritual capital. And investing in your spiritual capital is as important as investing in any other capitals.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like that. That's it makes it quite tangible, really, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's funny. It's a wild concept, but that was what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
There's a famous quote, and I know I believe it's a French philosopher, and I'm not going to try to reproduce his name right now, but one of the quotes I use in the book, in the legacy book, is he's known for the quote of, we're not human beings on a spiritual journey, we're spiritual beings on a human journey.
Yeah.
And I think that captures a bit of why I think spiritual capital is an important capital to have in its own category as part of the landscape of capitals we all have.
Yeah, I think that tends to be forgotten in sort of day-to-day life often, but it's I also quite like the analogy of the personal GPS, because that sort of, you know, illustrates very in a very good manner, you know, what it actually does for you and why it's important. Now then, of course, you know, once you realize what it is and that it is important, how can you actually integrate that into the whole process of living a legacy mindset?
Yeah, and that's a bit of what I try to do in the rest of the chapters of the book. The big picture of the book is, besides kind of laying the foundation early on, which I think you got a glimpse in when you read what you read, the heart of the book is my attempt to provide a framework, ideas, research, and real-life anecdotes, which I disguised, of how to answer what I'll call the five questions, if not every family, most families are asking and maybe even wrestling with. Mm. And in no particular order, they are, and this is literally based on me sitting across the, as you said earlier, the kitchen table or the conference room table, and being so fortunate to be able to serve and get in front of so many of the individuals and families I had at the time of writing the book, and now it's even more. But one of the topics that came up is, how do I basically raise happy people, happy children, happy next generation? They would say that in their own words, but they were basically saying, yeah, I know we have all these resources, and some of them scare them because they don't want to create entitled children or spoiled children and things like that. But they were like, I just want to raise happy kids. So that is one of the chapters. We're like, okay, is there anything to this thing on happiness? And many of your listeners may know there's a ton of growing research on what contributes to a meaningful and happy life.
Yeah.
So I did my best in summarizing that, adding my own flavor, and having a whole chapter on, well, what can you do about raising happy people? And just to give away a few ideas, is how do we help those that we care about and love experience achievement, share and give with others, be part of something larger than themselves, practice gratitude, right? There's practical things that contribute to a meaningful and happy life. So that was one of the questions that I'm hoping to help provide a map and a framework for families and individuals. The second question was transferring your wealth. So as you might already understand, that I am not talking from an estate perspective of transferring wealth or tax perspective, which is, again, what I'm hoping legacy and the book is contributing to, is that I'm talking about it from the qualitative side. What is your this is the questions that I'm addressing. What are your beliefs about money?
Yeah.
What are your values? What are you trying to accomplish, in other words, with your resources and future generations? How do you transfer? Do you transfer wealth while you're alive or not? And so I'm answering these, what I believe are these other really important questions, not just the questions which are important of how do you do this in a tax-efficient way, protecting assets, minimizing liabilities, titling correctly. Those, like I said, I've done that and I've updated it twice now. So that's the second one, is how do we transfer our wealth, thinking about it more strategically on a qualitative side. The third question is, now how do we prepare the next generation, or what commonly is referred to as the rising generation, for the stewardship and leadership in the family, of the family's resources, or some portion of them? And I'll just highlight one thing in that section. So basically what I do is I lay out 10 principles and practices for the next generation to follow or to use as a guide so they can prepare themselves. But I start with the 10 principles and practices that the leading generation, the wealth holders, the entrepreneurs, the wealth creators, what they need to do so that they're preparing the next generation. So I didn't see that much in the research. It's usually like, what do we do for the next generation? Like, give them financial education. That seems to be the conventional knee-jerk response.
Yeah.
That chapter's a little differently. And then two more questions, is, and you touched on it earlier, the topic of philanthropy, but not just writing the checks or donating the financial capital, as so important as that is I use the framework of fishes, as we talked about, and say, how do you do philanthropy through those fishes capitals? And now that really resets that, even, for example, if the next generation of leaders in the families don't yet have ownership of significant final resources, financial resources, that doesn't mean that they can't be charitable.
Yeah.
So that's that chapter. And then the other chapter related to the five topics is, how does family members who work together in a business or in a shared asset, like a private foundation, what do they need to succeed together as a family? And I make the case there that there's a set of skills that, even if we're related by blood or marriage and we love each other, we might not always have the skills needed to successfully work together or share assets.
Yeah.
So I lay out a set of skills there.
Yeah. Well, I really, that resonates a lot, because, you know, as I said, we have five kids and we see them fighting all the time. I mean, they get along quite well, but it's sort of, you think, well, how are they going to get along in the future when they're grown up? And, you know, I mean, I suppose everybody who's got siblings has some of that experience. I agree. I mean, it does take more than just growing up together to actually be able to work together and, you know, have a common goal or direction, at least. It doesn't even need to be the goal, but the direction.
Yeah, one of the families I served many years ago, it was now the generation two who were in their 40s and 50s, maybe 50s and 60s. They were having, and this is, I use this a lot because I think it illustrates the point you and I just talked about. They were having conflict or disagreements over the foundation that was transferred to their generation from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And They were not agreeing on how they should give the money away. And one of the adults in that generation said, "Mom and Dad gave me the value of generosity in my heart. I don't need to give it away to those legacy donors anymore." Or the one that was closest to Mom and Dad when they were doing their charitable work when their parents were alive said, "No, I want to continue to honor what Mom and Dad, who they were giving to." So yeah. I use it because this was giving away money and they couldn't. Yeah. They didn't have an alignment. They had conflict over giving away money, let alone trying to lead it or grow it or share it. It's an important part that I think was missing in the conversation of, okay, we're related, but we also need skills. And we see this with the clients we're serving right now. It's just because you're my brother, you're my sister, you're my dad, doesn't mean we know how to negotiate, communicate, resolve conflict, forgive one another.
Also, I think, you know, that may all work well as long as the leading generation is still around. But once they're not, you know, they're all up to themselves and they have to, you know, make themselves work as a team rather than, you know, being guided from a parent or their parents as a team.
Perfect. Yep. Yeah. And so some of the work in our family engagements is that we'll do work just with the next generation of siblings or cousins, and we'll put them through simulations where they have to start practicing making decisions together around shared assets so that they start to, because you're right on, usually when the matriarch and patriarch are still in the picture, they're going to provide the governing body or the family office will, but when it gets put, if they don't have practice doing it together, it doesn't mean it's going to automatically break, but it could be a bit harder for sure.
Well, I also think that, you know, the philanthropy bit of the equation can go a long way to enable that at a young age, because you can, it's relatively easy, I think, to involve the kids in that and get them working together and start making decisions and et cetera. But, you know, that's just a tool, I suppose. And presumably,
and you're right. Let me just build on that, because you're right. I think that's a very common starting point for families to bring in the next generation, for all the reasons you were hinting at there. It's a learning, it's a collaboration, it's team building, it's shared. It's a way to illustrate values. It's to get the actual experience of dealing with organizations. We call them 501c3s in the U.S. I don't know what they're called over in Europe. But basically charitable organizations. Yeah. But here's something that we've been seeing over the last year or two, and this may be unique to the U.S., North America. I'm not sure. But we're starting to see the next generation having meaningfully different views on wealth than their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So they might be some more wrestling or tension now in certain families when they're trying to do philanthropy together. Because, and so I can think of two families we've served just in this year or serving, where the parent generation will have a mission around their giving and they'll define what they want to give to. And the next generation will not only have a different, let's say, it's not even like they're just saying, "Oh, I have another charity we can give to," but it's almost like a different base of philosophy on where the money should go.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to find more. Abortion would be one.
Yeah.
The parents might say, "We're not going to support abortion." And the next generation would be, "Are you kidding me? Of course, why wouldn't we do that?" That would be a very overt one. And then there's other social justice conversations going on all over the world, but I think clearly in the U.S. on, is wealth intrinsically good, or should this all be given away as soon as possible?
Yeah.
So we're seeing those conversations. So we are hopefully getting wiser on our end, learning. We're always learning. Period. We're always learning, but we're trying to. We would normally jump to that philanthropy as one of those really good places for families to come together. And now we're maybe walking into it a little slower, asking a few more questions just to see if it's going to be a place where they could negotiate. Yeah. Or will it cause hard feelings?
Okay. Do you also see that the way that they're giving away money causes friction? Because I think like nowadays you've got a sort of impact investing and topics like that rather than just giving away donations. Is that a cause for friction and conflict, or is that more?
Well, yeah, potentially that's another expression of where I was kind of going is like, yeah, like why it could be even as why are our investments in these companies that we don't believe in, that they don't represent the right things that, and so, yeah. And the example you gave too, right? So those are all the different areas where we know that each generation is going to have their unique perspective and we honor that. What we're seeing is that those unique perspectives, at least here in North America, are in some families more heated than, hey, I just got a different different perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're trying to help the family, you know, flourish as a family as well as their assets. So we're just trying to be wise on how to do that. Yeah. But yes, your example would be another one of those. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Okay. Now, what I also found interesting or find interesting is that you've worked with individuals and families who manage first generation money and then some second, third, fourth, maybe even fifth generation money. And I'm intrigued to find out, do you see a difference there in approaching that whole topic of legacy, family wealth, intergenerational family wealth, etc., between the sort of newer wealthy families and the older money?
Yes, and broadly speaking, 100%. So if when we serve generation three, generation four, generation five, which statistically there's not that many in comparison to G2 and G1 and G3. Yeah. But yes, I would say some of the broad differences are that if the wealth has already made it to G4 or G5, the family has put in some practices, for example, that could be a very mature, established family office, clear governance, strong, trusted advisors, family rituals that maybe bring the family together at least, you know, once or twice a year. So, yeah, there's an element of and there could be a lot more owners.
Yeah,
especially if there's a family enterprise, even if they're not operators, or they're even, you know, teenagers, they could be still owners by the way the family practices wealth transfer and things like that. So I would say there's a more of a maturity, but I don't want to use that word incorrectly. There's a more of a seasoning that the family has been dealing with the resources moving through generations. Mm-hmm. What generally we would find is their opportunities and why they might engage us tends to be things like how to get the next generation engaged in the prior generation's efforts. You know, do we plug them into a committee? At what age are they involved? They're in college, they're not interested, but we want to start preparing them to be interested in the family legacy. So there tends to be a bit of a theme of, not that there's not improvements on governance and structures and things like that. There's always a sharpening there. It's more like how do we now engage the next 60 family members when you're down to that level, or 40, whatever the numbers are. That tends to be the topic at hand. I'd say with generation one and generation two wealth, I don't think I'm saying anything that you're not familiar with. Their generation one and generation two are getting used to the wealth, especially if the wealth has, there's been some liquidity. Let's say there's a family business, a meaningful amount of liquidity in addition to the enterprise or the business. I think they're tend to be what we call still culturally running as a mom and pop culture, meaning it's the generation one. It's mostly the founder style that permeates how everything gets done.
Yeah.
And generation two has gotten to witness most of how that wealth was created and maybe is now contributing to it. And a lot of that work we'll put in the category, and we're doing it right now with a number of families. We'll put it in the category of the transition planning or continuity planning, which we see once you move out of G1 and G2 of the wealth creation, if it's not there already, that's when they tend to need more of what we call the scaffolding or the governance.
Yeah.
Okay. It's okay when matriarch and patriarch are talking to their three children, and that's pretty easy to maintain. But what happens when you got the next 15 cousins consortium? And so we're actively involved with families right now. Does the business continue? What roles does everyone have? What is the governance? It's not just dad making all the decisions anymore.
Yeah.
So we tend to find that's where we have to put in more of the structure, or we call it scaffolding.
Yeah. I mean, yes, obviously. I mean, as you go down the generations and you have an increasing number of stakeholders, obviously you need to think more about the formalized structures that you put in place and how you even keep the herd together, I suppose.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. And what is the vision? I mean, literally what I'm about to share with you is questions I'm helping families think through and fill out now, is what is the vision for the enterprise?
Yeah.
If it's not family operated, or not primarily family operated, is it going to stay family controlled? Do you still want the business to continue even if not a lot of family members come into it? So on a smaller scale, there's one of our families just decided that as long as one of this next generation, in this case it's generation three, is willing to be an executive leader and operator of the business, we're going to have it family owned and operated. But if not, they're not sure. They're not sure what they're going to do. So it's even having them think about beyond what's in front of them, what's the vision for the enterprise?
Yeah. That's a whole other topic, I suppose, you know, because if you look at a business, it's often the biggest component in the portfolio of assets. And of course, it's then you have a, you know, it's a bulky asset. It's not very liquid. And of course it's a concentrated risk. Right. Depending on how you look at it, if you look at it from the vision perspective and ideology, or you know that sort of framework, it's of course a different perspective. But if you look at it just rationally from an investment management point of view, you should probably diversify away from one concentrated asset. But of course, that's not the only parameter that comes into the equation.
Yeah, I was in a meeting with a family of a company that everyone, at least in the U.S., would know. And I remember the patriarch looking at it in a very nice way, but looking at his children saying, you don't have to come into the business.
Yeah.
Whether you do or not, this business will stay family controlled. Right. So he was very clear that this entity was going to continue on whether the next generation came into it.
Yeah.
I have another family we're serving right now where in his landscape, in their landscape of assets, there is a very, like you said, a very chunky asset that's most of the wealth creation sitting in there. But he said, no, that one's not meant for my children to come into. That's going to be operated by a professional team. But this and this is if my children want to, here's the paths they can come. So yeah, just helping them think about their landscape and their intended legacies.
Yeah. Again, I think, you know, that's where you should be working with intent rather than, you know, chance or luck or whatever you want to call it, or destiny. So I mean, this show is about implementing and learning. So you know, I'm curious. I'm a generation one entrepreneur. So what are your 3 to 5 top tips on how to get this set up and started?
I don't touch on it as directly as you're asking, but if in the book Legacy, I hopefully will provide a framework, especially in the chapter of, well, all the chapters, but the two that I think maybe is most direct to that is an element of preparing the next generation, because baked into that is what do we do as the wealth creators or the leading generation. Yeah. And then the chapter on transferring wealth, how to think about that, because irrespective of whatever your vision might be, you're still going to need to do that aspect of planning on estate planning or tax planning and wealth planning. So I would say a few things. One is to get clear or to begin, because it's going to be an organic process. We're going to grow and change and evolve as family grows and as we learn. But I'd say start by getting a little clearer on your intended legacy. And what I mean by that is, as we talked about, your life and your resources.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you mean? And then to the degree you could be clear on that, what does that potentially mean for the family, your five children in your example, and potentially their children? Can you see a connection to that? And what is you and your wife's philosophy on how much you're going to strongly persuade the other generations to be part of what you're doing? Or if not, how are your assets and your intended legacy going to support what they're trying to do?
Yeah.
I'd say that's not a bad place to start. Obviously, have your key trusted advisors around you to make sure that all the proper planning is in place. That's two. Maybe the third one is to have, you could do it yourself or have a trusted third party facilitate family meetings for you with your family, so that you can, what we mean by family meetings is not necessarily you just dictating to everyone that you care about what you think, although that might be part of the family meeting, you sharing what you think and what you believe and what you hope. But a family meeting, especially with at least young adults and adults, is to have the meeting with an agenda that kind of represents everyone's ideas and voices, so that you as a family are learning and growing together.
Yeah.
And I think building that ritual in as soon as you can will provide your family, no matter how many resources you have, with a place to be what we call the business of being family.
Yeah.
And that's where you could bring in your trusted advisors. That's where you could bring in subject matter experts.
Yeah.
Or that could just be where you guys get together to learn and have some fun together.
Yeah.
I would say those aren't the only places to start, but I think those few places is not a bad place to go.
What age would you start that? With, I mean, the children's age, I mean.
The family meetings? So my children are now 15, 16, and 24. We've been, with the younger ones, we've been doing family meetings for years. And let me define what a family meeting is. Because they're younger, we had one last night. So we do it once a month on Sunday evenings.
Mm-hmm.
And we literally go into the family room and sit on the couch, and my wife and I may have an agenda of topics we want to discuss. We may not, but for every once a month, informally, we're sitting on the couch and we might go through topics. Like last night, we talked about how they're performing in their school, we're complimenting them, how they're doing in their sports, and how we're going on vacation shortly to Italy, and how that's going to be an element of a celebration for the family. We talked about our faith. We talked about my son's thinking of starting a little business. So it's an age-appropriate family meeting.
Yeah.
But I would say, let's just call it 18 and older. That's where you could still do what I just said in your home, but getting outside of finding a more neutral location. And especially if it's facilitated by others, and start those family meeting practices. You might only start with a half a day, two or three, and then the second half a day you're playing with them. You're going somewhere on vacation.
Yeah.
You're experiencing something fun.
Yeah.
I'll give you one more practical example. And I learned this from one of our families. In their family, until you were age 13, you could not enter the family meeting that they did every year. And then and their family meeting started with philanthropy. Until that 13-year-old reached the age of 18, they had to leave the family meeting after the philanthropy part, because the rest of the meeting was now going to be quite transparent about the family's financial picture. And I asked them, what was your philosophy? Like, why 13 and then why 18? And they said they believe that if they had a number of years with their grandchildren or nieces and nephews, that they focused on the philanthropy part, they'd be better prepared at 18 to be able to absorb and understand the rest of the financial picture. So that was how one family did it.
Yeah, I suppose there's many ways to go about it, but that seems to me like a reasonable approach. Sounds as if it could work.
Yeah. But you could start early, like I did with, you know, I don't know if we started when they were 6 or 7 or 8, but just monthly and making it age appropriate. And there's a lot of like telling my son, come on, get back on the couch, put your phone down. But that's their ages. So you just roll with it.
There's a lot of practical challenges I find when you do these things. I mean, we do make a point of it, you know, a family dinner once a day. You know, we have the evening meal together, and but it's really stressful sometimes. But you know, I'm hoping it will pay off in the long term. Okay. Now, but you know, okay, you've given some tips on how you can get started, or you know, beginning to make it work. But in your experience or observation, what are the sort of 2 to 3 factors that lead to failure? Or problem,
I think. Or definitely making it harder is there's an expression we use based that we kind of just evolved out of our work. Was we say, do you love your children enough not to give them everything you can? And so why I start there is because loving wealth creators or wealth holders, because they have a lot of resources and they're busy, will tend to make life a bit easy for their children and grandchildren. And one has to consider, is that really good for the flourishing of the next generation? And going back to the happiness chapter in my book, if you read what contributes to happiness and a meaningful life, it's not having everything paid for, everything funded, and you're protected from all problems.
Yeah.
Or even rescued from problems. So that would be one thing that parents unintentionally or grandparents unintentionally do, is they'll make life much too easy financially in other ways for their loved ones. Another one is, I think the idea, and we have a lot of empathy for this, which is why some of the programs and some of the family engagements we do cover this topic. But most, in my experience, overwhelmingly 90%+ of the wealth creators are not ready to be transparent about the family's financial picture. And I think that's probably wise for some period of time. So in the spirit of being silent on being transparent, they tend to not say much about the family's purpose of their wealth, their intentions of their wealth, the role of wealth in supporting their lives or not supporting their lives. Is there going to be a family bank? Are they going to finance their grandchildren's education? So what we like to say is, you could talk about the topic of money today with your loved ones. You could talk about your values, your purpose, your intended legacy today.
Yeah,
that's not synonymous with, therefore, family, we're worth 100 million and you might all be worth 20 million one day. That last piece could be held off for a long time while you're moving towards transparency. So I'd say I understand it, but if the parents or the grandparents or generation 3 stays silent, you're probably not really preparing for your intended legacy.
It can be a big shock then.
And then, Yeah, exactly. It's almost, yeah, that's right. And they're not equipped. So commonly in our work with families is it's very customized. It's very much based on who they are and their values and their readiness. But it's a fairly common practice where we'll say, okay, you're worth this number, and this number is very large, and your children are making $60,000 a year, and even though you paid for their college, they have no sense of what they might be responsible for. What if you found a way to give them access through advisors in partnership with advisors of, I'm making it up, $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, not for them to spend, but for them to begin to have some role of stewardship around.
Yeah.
And you can put the parameters on how it's used. So just those incremental moves could help in the development. So it isn't, like you said, a shock to their system and they're really not prepared.
Yeah. All right.
And then I'd say the third one is not knowing how to handle conflict. And it's not easy in families. I'd say, we're working with a few families right now, helping them create in their family charter a conflict resolution policy. Mm-hmm. My team calls it building bridges, because it's inevitable that family members and generations are going to have different perspectives. That's a given.
Yes.
So how do you build those bridges so that we're minimizing or capitalizing on those different perspectives?
Yeah, that's a good point, because the difference can actually add value, can it not? So
that's exactly right. Yeah. That's okay. Exactly right.
So do you have a quick tip on how to build bridges?
Yeah, well, we actually have a short little seminar that we do for our families. And it goes back to, and we have an assessment tool, which is called our Family Skills Success Index.
Mm-hmm.
And what we'll say is the snapshot to where their skills are strong, mm-hmm. and where they're not, we try to help them build out those skills, whether it's, again, communication, negotiation. So I don't know if I have a quick one. I'd say the quickest thing I'd say is helping normalize for family that you do and will have different perspectives, and conflict is not a problem.
Yeah.
It's destructive. Destructive conflict is the problem.
Yeah.
If you could properly wrestle through and negotiate through conflict or differences of opinion, as you just said a moment ago, it might bring the family further along.
Yes.
Than burying. Yeah. It's when it becomes unproductive and it just spirals down. That's where our role is, to try to not let that happen.
Yeah.
So normalizing it, I guess, would be my first, just calling it out and just normalizing it for a family that if you're not experiencing it, if you ever experience tension or different opinions, you can almost count on it's going to happen. Now, how do we maximize that for the sake of the family?
Yeah. Love it. Okay. So what does true wealth mean for you as a person?
Mm. Well, it's funny you ask that, because my wife and I try to do our best to practice what we teach. And so we had to come up with a definition, because my children are asking, Mom, Dad, are we rich?
Mm.
And so here's our definition. So this is just very personal, so no one has to follow it, but our definition is, are you healthy?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have people who love and care for you?
Mm-hmm.
Then you're wealthy. If you have money on top of that, man, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Man, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's our definition of true wealth.
Yeah.
Health, people who love you, and if you have money on top of that, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Love it. That's it. I like it. Yeah, very good. Now, in terms of creating true wealth for yourself via financial wealth, impact, purpose, succession, and legacy, what do you consider your own key achievements to date?
Finding my wife and having the courage to marry her. I knew once that started, I wanted children. Having children, but not overly, and this is not easy, but being aware of not overly trying to plan their life, but to guide their life. I'll give you, just as a side note, one of the couples we served who had young kids, much younger than mine, their philosophy was, and I thought it was interesting, they said, we're referring to the couple, we see ourselves as the CEO of our children's lives so that we can prepare them that when they get older, they'll be the CEOs of their own lives, and we'll shift to being on their advisory board.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting way to think about it. So back to your question is, I'd say in terms of my legacy and intended legacy is my wife, my children, and my and this is all integrated. Legacy Capitals, which is the firm I founded, the team that I work with, and the clients we serve. How we do that as a team and who our team is and the families we get honored to be put in front of, that is the biggest expression of our legacy, because what we're trying to do is not define other people's legacy, but whatever the families and couples that we serve, helping them define their legacies and live them out. Those are in development, but I would say those are definitely the most important. And something I haven't mentioned yet related to legacy is also a good portion of our work is that we work with the advisors to families and we train them on what we call whole family advising. And we're giving them a process, a toolkit, solutions to serve their families on a more qualitative aspect in the way that our team is doing. So we're trying to extract from what we do and equip advisors to do it. So we do a lot of that. And that's also part of our offering, which is also baked in. It's an online training program that's on our website.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like
That's part of our legacy too. That's really part of our legacy building.
That's obviously how you can generate a lot of, or you can use a lot of leverage basically.
It's helping build disciples.
Yeah, exactly. So in your quest to build that legacy, what have been your biggest challenges and how have you overcome them?
Yeah, I don't know if I've overcome them. I think we're trying to learn from them and be better at them. We'll move on or pivot. But two things come to mind. One is on the family, there's the business side, which I'll talk about. Let me start there because that's important, but not as important as the people side, in my opinion. So we're fortunate to keep growing as a firm, and we're fortunate to have amazing people on a team. But the good news is that we continue to grow, and it's to find like-minded professionals that we can add to what we're trying to do, where there's an alignment of values and philosophy, and trying to, from a business perspective, build a business that's both scalable so that we can serve all the advisors and families as well. And I think that is it's a challenge for any growing business, but it's definitely a challenge for us. And we're doing things based on some of these challenges to grow and see how we can best stay who we are and stay what our core value is to the families and advisors. That's really who we serve. But yet grow and meet the growing demand, which is awesome.
Yeah.
On the, we'll call it the engagement side, the challenge, and we're still trying to figure out, is how do we believe that what we're trying to do is provide that wisdom piece, not just what's the best practice, which is relevant, but what's the wisdom? What does this family believe is best for them to do now? Mm-hmm. Not is it right? Is it wrong? I mean, there's some things that are wrong. There's some things that are right. But helping families more through a wisdom lens on what's best for you now. And that's not always easy to know. So where to help a family start so that they're experiencing success in how they define it, or they're asking us to help them define it.
Yeah.
That's not an easy task. Because we're not just going back to the start of our conversation. We're not selling widgets, and I don't believe that serving families is you bring in 10 best practices and you lay it on them. I think that's what's limiting in how we add value. So I think it's that wisdom piece, which is a challenge, and it's okay. It's going to be an ongoing challenge, but I think that's the more meaningful piece, that if we can help families tap, either bring wisdom to them in the sense that, all right, we've now been serving families for, well, me, almost 2 decades, not to mention what the team has. It's how do we help them find wisdom in what's best for them? Because it's not everything isn't a black and white answer.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. And you personally, what do you want to be remembered for?
I fortunately have this answer because I was a few years ago, the end of last year, we were doing training for advisors. And before we started the training, the head of the firm with the advisors who were about to go through the training, and Kristen, my colleague, and I, my partner and I in business, were having dinner together. And we'll call it the CEO, the head of the organization, asked everyone to come up with 3 words that will define their legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, wow, no one ever asked me that. So now I have to come up with an answer. So my answer is what I've come up with there is, the words I want to be known for are love, innovation, and impact.
Uh-huh.
That's what I, at the end of the day, love is the most important thing. I want those who have I had a chance to, my family, of course, my friends, my clients, my team. Love, I don't think there's anything more important. It's not easy to live that way, but it's why it's the name of my second book, which is called Love Your Clients. But love, innovation, meaning kind of going to the theme of, let's not just do the conventional, what's really the wise thing to do here. Let's think differently about or expand how we think. And impact. I mean, if we're not, my legacy is having no impact and I go to the grave and there's not many people saying, well, Rich was somehow, or Legacy Capitals was somehow a positive impact in our lives. I don't know if that was as great of a life.
Yeah.
And more to the point, my children and my wife.
Yes. Yeah. I like the answer. It's a good answer. And you obviously went on the way. So, but
we're trying.
Yeah. But do you think there's room for improvement, or what, in other words, where do you still want to go?
Well, yeah, I guess my real life experience is always room for improvement, whether it's learning, being wiser, our team has awesome, we have quarterly meetings and we have debates and we sharpen each other. So I think by definition, there's always going to be improvement. I would say on the business side, and I kind of hinted at this already, I believe we don't know exactly what this means, but we believe as a team that we're not done serving who we're supposed to serve. So now I just hired a business consultant that's working with me, and it's seeing in this, in the spirit of growing again and improving.
Mm-hmm.
We think that we're meant to be serving more advisors so that they could serve their clients. And we have a little prayer that basically says, you know, give us help us be the best stewards we can of those who are meant to serve. And so we feel like we have more people to serve, and we're just trying to figure out how to be wise in building a team, a business, and content to serve those we're meant to serve. So, yeah, we got some runway to keep going.
Very good. Very good. Is there anything that you feel is missing, or anything that could really be helpful for you? I mean, this is basically the part where you can shout out to the audience and you know, ask for help or assistance or anything that you might need in terms of support or connections or whatever.
Well, let me start by saying thank you, Sasha, for this invitation and the encouragement, and that you're in another country and yet you're, from what I could tell, we haven't worked together, but your heart and mind and your podcast are oriented in the same, it feels very aligned with what we're trying to do. So that's encouraging. So thank you for this. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for this conversation. And I guess my first thought is that I hope that everything I do in terms of my intended legacy is I hope that this conversation you and I have somehow is what a individual or a couple or an advisor needs to hear to help them live their legacy, live their intended legacy.
Yeah.
Practically, that's the biggest, I hope, and wish and intention here. Practically speaking, if there's advisors who want the training, so because they want to get better at this, they can just go to Legacy Capitals, and that's with an S, legacycapitals.com, and we have self-directed training online. And then to the degree it makes sense for a couple or a family to want to explore something with us, they can go to legacycapitals.com and our contact information's on there as well. But other than that, I hope I've contributed in some way to what you're trying to do, Sasha, with your intended legacy, because you're the creator of this podcast. So I appreciate this and enjoy it.
I'm sure you contributed a lot, and I think it was a very valuable conversation. And actually, you've answered my next question, where people can find you. I presume it's via legacycapitals.com. Is that the best way, or is there any other?
No, I would say that's definitely a way where you can get some more information, access to training. If for some reason you wanted to send an email directly, just send it to Richard Orlando at legacycapitals, again with the S.com.
Is that with a dot in between, or just Richard Orlando?
Richard Orlando, nothing in between, just two words together. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. We'll put that in the show notes. And now the last question, and this is kind of a signature question by now, is if there was one thing and only one thing that you could change about our planet, our society, the world we live in, what would that be?
What a small question there, Sasha. Is to know God's love.
Sorry?
Is to know God's love.
Okay, yes. Yeah.
Because that'll change a lot.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, well, thank you, Richard. I mean, I thank you a lot for being on the conversation, for, you know, bringing all your experience and knowledge into the conversation. I personally think I took a lot from it, and I hope our audience will too. Well, let's see. I think, you know, I'll read the book, and then we'll see if there's a scope for a follow-up conversation, but I have a feeling there might be. But I say that quite often to my guests, actually, and we've had repeat guests. So, you know, I do follow up on these things. So thanks again for being on the show. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope our audience will too. So thanks for being here, and take care.
Thank you very much.